So on the 35th episode of the Loopcast, I'm here with Afshan, and we're going to talk about the Revolutionary Guard and sort of their history and their dynamic in Iran, and sort of we'll end with the Iranian elections and their role in Iran's, you know, elections this year. So let's start off with, you know, who are sort of the Revolutionary Guard in the sense of, you know, give us a basic history, because I think it's a name and a sort of acronym IRGC that we hear a lot, but we don't really, I think in the public sources or the, you know, think tank papers, there's not a lot of history. So walk us through, you know, from 1979 until, you know, whenever.
Sure. Okay. Well, very briefly, the IRGC started as a meta militia, as a grouping of a lot of pro-Khomeini militias that were involved in the revolution. And its first priority was twofold. One was to sort of secure the revolution and Khomeini's standing in the revolution. So to push out competitors that were, even at that time, more or less aligned with Khomeini. But also those that were quite against Khomeini, like Mojaheddin al-Khalq or the Maoists, like Pekar. The other thing was that they were seen as sort of a people's army. They were sort of seen as an authentic Islamic alternative to what had been the hated military of the Shah's regime, right? So it was an alternative to the military. And one ultimately meant to replace the military, but that never happened.
So where do we put the Basij in this? Because from what I understand of it, it was a sort of, they developed at the same time, or was there a sort of split? Like the IRGC came first, then the Basij, or, you know?
The IRGC
at least
came
in the beginning.
Yeah, the IRGC came first, but not by a whole lot. The Basij started in 1980. Khomeini had this phrase, the 20 million man army, that he used to talk about, which was the idea that Iran could defeat its enemies because by sheer sort of population mass, that it had so many people, so many believers, that they could withstand any sort of conflict. So the Basij was sort of started up as this popular volunteer militia that quickly, very quickly, sort of became involved in the Iran-Iraq War. I don't think it was envisioned to be an infantry division, but that's what it effectively became. But during the Iran-Iraq War, at least in the early years, those that joined the Basij were those that were either seen as too young, too old, or somehow ill-fitted to proper military service. So in the beginning, the Basij was mostly young people and old people who joined the war out of faith, out of belief, out of nationalism, and everything else.
So how did the Iran-Iraq War affect the IRGC and the Basij's development? Because, you know, I think before we get into the economy, it seems like, you know, the Iran-Iraq War has left, you know, a fairly large scar on, you know, Iran's economic and sort of, you know, on a huge group of individuals. But walk us through, you know, how did the Iran-Iraq War affect the development politically of the IRGC and, you know, the Basij?
Right. Okay. Well, if the revolution was the fire that sort of gave birth to the IRGC, the Iran-Iraq War was the anvil that kind of shaped it into an organization, right? The IRGC was basically a ragtag militia when the Iran-Iraq War started. The Basij was, you know, a very, very simple hodgepodge group of older guys, younger people, women, that was more sort of faith-based than military. But through the years of the Iran-Iraq War, they both became military organizations. By the end of the Iran-Iraq War, the IRGC had sort of taken over from the regular army, sort of leadership of most war-fighting decision-making.
So would you describe this as a sort of professionalization, or would you describe this as more, you know, the army and the navy and the what we consider the traditional militaries were sort of sidelined and even destroyed, and then this organization, which already had combat experience, sort of stepped up? Or do you, you know, how would you, is this professionalization that happened, or was this you know, filling in a gap, so to speak, a governmental and institutional gap?
Professionalization, I think, is a loaded term here, right. In that it didn't necessarily occur. What had happened was the regular army remained, but because after the revolution, their top leadership were thrown out or killed or left or whatever, it didn't have, one, a lot of leadership capability that was well-developed, or two, that was trusted by the regime. So the IRGC was far more trusted by Khomeini and sort of the clerical leaders at that time, whereas the military was less trusted. However, Rafsanjani and folks of his ilk saw the military as far more competent than the IRGC. And so they never divested the army of certain resources that it always had, which were, you know, the major military technology, tanks, aircraft, navy, ships, whatever that was left remained for the most part within the regular army's purview. The IRGC became sort of a land force. It had a naval force and some other things, but it was sort of the lead force. It led most of the decision making, most of the war fighting plans, and it was far more engaged in the political aspects of war fighting than the military was, the regular military. So by the end of it, the IRGC had developed a close relationship with the leadership, not Rafsanjani, but with Khomeini, but they had not professionalized into a regular military.
So then when do we see sort of the irregular style of warfare come in? Because if I remember the Iraq War correctly, there was an attempt at least to sort of co-opt Iraqi Shiites. I think it was the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which would later take, as you know, everybody knows, later take a play a larger role in Iraqi politics, you know, post 2003. But you know, where do we factor in, you know, irregular warfare? Especially, let me sort of widen our example to Lebanon, because it was in the 80s that Iran started sort of stepping up its presence in Lebanon and sort of co-opting Shiite groups, would later become, as everybody knows, Hezbollah. But you know, walk us through that. When does you know, irregular warfare become, you know, part of the doctrine, part of the practice?
Well, I mean, in terms of irregular warfare, like most of what the IRGC was doing was in some ways considered irregular warfare, right? Or guerrilla-style warfare. I mean, these guys were all urban guerrillas. The leadership was all urban guerrillas, and they became sort of commanders, guys like Yahya Rahim Safavi or Mohsen Rasai. All of these guys had led militias or been part of essentially terrorist groups in the 70s. In terms of their engagement with non-Iranian militant groups, that story's richer and much more complicated. So the Iranian adventure in Iraq and Lebanon rested fairly, almost entirely, on two networks. One was the clerical network that emanated out of Najaf, which was sort of fostered in the 50s and 60s, and to a lesser extent the 70s, that where Iranians and Lebanese and Iraqi clergy mixed. And then some went back to Lebanon, some stayed in Iraq, some went back to Iran, and after the revolution, they connected. And the second thing was Lebanon served as a base for a lot of Iranian revolutionaries during the 70s. They would go to Lebanon, and there was two main groups. There was a group that fought with the PLO, with Fatah, and there was a group that fought in the south with Amal. And the folks that worked with Amal and the folks that worked with Fatah were actually competitors in Lebanon, and they became competitors after the revolution. The folks that worked with Amal, in fact, Amal had, I don't know, several hundred Lebanese fighters that fought with the IRGC during the Iran-Iraq War. But they only lasted a short time. And ultimately, in Iran's internal politics, the guys that had worked with Fatah, guys like Rahim Safavi, were the ones that that sort of became dominant in the IRGC. So that's the basis of what happened. Now the IRGC gets involved in it sort of sideways, because along with the IRGC you had another organization called the Office of Liberation Movements. And the Office of Liberation Movements was essentially started by Iran's radical left. The guys that really saw themselves as sort of third worldist revolutionaries that felt like Iran's first and foremost effort should be to help revolutions everywhere else in the world, not just consolidate revolution at home. And so for them, the Iran-Iraq war was sort of tangential to what they wanted to do. What they wanted to do was create revolutions in Bahrain and Kuwait and Eritrea and Lebanon, even in America. Or South Africa, you know, they were you know, fairly squarely involved in leftist movements. The Office of Liberation Movements, however, ran afoul of both the Iranian leadership and IRGC leadership, who saw them as essentially rabble-rousing, getting involved in terrorist activities, really sort of complicating Iran's international effort. And so ultimately, after this one hiccup with a guy named Mehdi Hashemi, who was a relative by marriage to Ayatollah Montazeri, who was then Khomeini's successor-to-be, this guy was arrested in Saudi Arabia with a bunch of explosives, and he was going to do something with them. They arrested him, they sent him back to Iran, and Khomeini ultimately put him to death. And when this happened, it was over this flap that Montazeri protested against Khomeini, and that's what led to Montazeri no longer being his successor. But also when that happened, Montazeri supporters and Hashemi supporters within the IRGC were purged from the IRGC. So the guys that really led the effort to create Hezbollah and to create other groups around the world really were pushed aside by the IRGC. And the IRGC did not really consolidate those relationships, especially with Hezbollah, till after the war. The Office of Liberation Movements basically was disbanded, and what took its place was the Quds Force.
So let's sort of move beyond sort of the 80s and 90s, and or I guess the 80s, and sort of get into the 90s. So it seems like, you know, from what we've read, you know, this is when you know, the role of the IRGC in the economy becomes bigger. And so, you know, outline for us, you know, Rafsanjani and sort of the economic reforms he did, and sort of, you know, how the veterans of the Iran-Iraq War, not just the IRGC, not just, you know, the Basij, were sort of started to play a larger role in the economy. I mean, is this sort of, you know, Rafsanjani, you know, we consider him a foreign policy pragmatist, but I mean, in the sense of domestic structure, I mean, sort of outlier, you know, the role for us, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, Iran had a very big problem after the Iran-Iraq war. Well, several of them. One of them, its economy was in shatters. Two, unemployment was incredibly high. And three, it had this massive mobilized popular army, including Basijis, the IRGC and the regular army, that had fought, had died, had suffered, but there was nothing for them to go back to. So there was no jobs, there was nothing. They had a demobilization problem. They couldn't effectively demobilize all of their troops without serious social dislocation. So one of the things that Rafsanjani decided to do was, as part of his major reconstruction plan, he was the big, you know, the Reconstruction Crusade was his baby, was to get the IRGC, who had really no role at all in Iran outside of war fighting, to get them involved in domestic issues. So this would do two things. One, it would keep them occupied. Two, it would keep them employed. And Rafsanjani did not get along with IRGC leaders, and so there was a third element to this also, which was hopefully to keep them in line with his administration. So he created a lot of economic initiatives, and the IRGC started a development and construction arm that started taking on these massive state contracts, and it became a major contract. This happened, you know, throughout the 90s and even, you know, for the next 20 years up until today.
So before we move on, could you describe sort of, you know, where do we place these contracts in the larger, you know, larger Iranian economy? Are we talking about, you know, $100 million contracts of completely redoing downtown? Or are we talking, you know, what is the scale and what was the focus of, of these contracts?
In terms of the actual economic percentage, I have no clue. The scale was large, but they did mostly big industrial projects, right? So they built big hydroelectric dams. They did large railroad construction. They did pipeline construction. They did roads and highways and ditches. They did agricultural development. They did all sorts of these big land moving kind of issues. They also did other things. They, you know, retrofitted buildings and stuff like that.
So would this also include infrastructure like telecoms, like water? I mean, you're talking about everything associated with the state. And so where do we put, you know, in terms of, where do we put this economic participation in terms of religious money, in terms of like waqafs, banyads, and sort of, you know, the clergy in general? I mean, is this something that was developing parallel to not just the regular state's economy, but also a religious economy, or was this all sort of blurred? So there wasn't really a finer distinction between, you know, who owns what company and who is benefiting from what?
Well, I mean, in terms of who owns what and who was benefiting, I think that was certainly blurry. But in terms of, you know, where the money was coming from, it was state money. You know, it was quite different than Vox or Bonyads. But I mean, it's blurry. I mean, nobody has great details on this stuff. This is broad stroke stuff that people understand. But what people do understand is that the IRGC became a major state contractor. And with those major state contracts that they started developing in the early 90s, they were able to expand their influence domestically, but also their economics. It didn't necessarily change them into a rich organization. You know, they still have problems paying their soldiers. They have problems with, you know, they have crappy barracks and stuff like that. I mean, they're not some elite institution, but some senior commanders were seriously benefiting from the largesse of the government.
So, my mind just went blank. So where would you put sanctions in all this? Because I think a common argument was that sort of both, you know, from a perspective of advocacy and academia, is that sort of sanctions forced sort of the IRGC into this economic role. I mean, is there a truth to that? Is the evidence points to this argument, or is this really sort of Rafsanjani worried about domestic politics and structuring the economy in such a way that, you know, to shore up his base or to shore up, you know, stability of the regime?
Yeah, it's as far as I understand it, it was primarily a domestic issue. You know, this was a way of solving several problems. I mean, the IRGC seriously disliked Rafsanjani and continues to dislike Rafsanjani for several reasons. Rafsanjani was always on the other side of every issue during the Iran-Iraq war, and Mohsen Rezaei and Rafsanjani were the principals in much of the war fighting decision making. So they didn't want to end the war. Rafsanjani made them end the war. They were bitter about that. Also, right after the war, they were convinced that Rafsanjani was going to disband the IRGC altogether. He had gotten rid of their ministry. They used to have an independent ministry. He fused it with the Ministry of the Regular Army to make the Ministry of Defense. He disbanded the committees. The committees were an important part of security operations domestically in Iran throughout the 80s. They were also the last bastion of leftist Islamist influence within Iran's security forces. He disbanded those, and the IRGC thought they would disband him. In fact, a lot of the writing coming out of the IRGC after the war was that Rafsanjani was going to disband them. So he had a serious trust deficit with the IRGC. And it's my contention, I could be wrong, that part of his desire or part of the move to bring in the IRGC closer to the government was partially to assuage any attempts that they would resist his leadership.
So in 1995, you have Khatami who comes to power, who I think in the West, I think it's 1995.
It's 97.
97. Sorry, 2 years off.
No, you're
right. No, it's okay. Yeah. But
when is it?
I think it was 95.
It's 2005, 8 years.
Yeah.
No, 2007. Yeah, 2005, so 8 years.
Oh. Well, anyway.
97.
So he comes to power. But you have all these construction projects that are going on after Rafsanjani, or during Rafsanjani. But, you know, what was the interpretation of the IRGC of Khatami? Because I think in the West, you know, I think the popular line during the Clinton administration was that he's a reformer, he's going to bring Iran back to this, you know, more democratic period. But I mean, from what you've told us, all the construction projects initiated under Rafsanjani would also be going on during Khatami, and really the building up of Iran's economy was sort of, you know, projects led by the IRGC. So, I mean, walk us through, you know, what was Khatami's relationship with the IRGC? Was there a tension between this, you know, supposed opening to the West? And
sure. I mean, one thing I'll say is I don't want to give the impression that the IRGC was Iran's economy. I mean, they just had one slice of it that allowed them to sort of allow some guys to get rich and also become more influential. Khatami was different because what the IRGC and the Basij became involved in after the war was sort of the war veterans movement, for lack of a better word. War veterans, you know, were an important constituency in the 90s. I mean, they still are to a lesser extent. And they felt like they had fought and died and they should receive something. So all of the presidents, in some way or another, I shouldn't say presidents, but Rafsanjani and other leadership, you know, would play to this constituency. They would promise them things, they would give them things. They ultimately didn't get very much at all, but they felt like they deserved something. And they were very much against what they saw as any sort of creeping Western influence, because they thought this is ultimately what they were fighting against. And so things like Western fashions, Western music, Western movies were things that they would actively criticize and move against in Iranian society. When there was polling done, I remember reading some poll among student Basij in the run-up to Khatami's election, and Khatami, was either number one or number two. He polled very highly among the student Basij. And I think from what I gather, he probably was also fairly popular within the lower ranks of the IRGC, and especially the conscript rank and file. He was a popular figure in 97. People were excited about him, and I don't think that, while the IRGC leadership, I think, was totally against him, IRGC members and Basijis themselves, I don't think were against him in the beginning. That quickly changed, and what changed it mostly was the 1999 university protests. That sort of turned the tide against Khatami. Basijis, who were already against him, and the IRGC, who were already against him, took that as an excuse to move radically against him. So you had the Basij sort of step up, morals policing, you know, the IRGC, you know, of course, wrote that incredible letter to Khatami that, you know, essentially said, if you don't do something, we will, which is a pretty serious threat coming from, you know, your military. And so, no, they didn't like him. But their status in Iran never changed. In fact, that gave them more power, because they were able to threaten a president completely get away with it. And they were able to get away with a lot of other things. There was pastiches that were convicted of a string of murders in Kerman in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it went through several layers of Iran's court system, and ultimately the case against them got thrown out because they had murdered essentially young couples that weren't married, and they said, you know, because they were having illicit sex, they were their blood could be shed. You know, they were going against Islam, and ultimately Mesbayazdi and Khamenei sided with them, right? So you had these examples of bastiges essentially, literally, actually, getting away with murder, and that being okay with the supreme leader. And so that to me, more than anything else, sort of let Iranian society know who was going to be favored and who was not going to be favored.
So let's flash forward 2 years, or 3 years, to 2002 and U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. So what was the IRGC's response to, you know, the United States going into Afghanistan in 2002? You know, was this, you know, I think the popular line is that, you know, in Iran they were sort of glad that, you know, the United States had eliminated the Taliban, or, you know, I guess in 2002 would eliminate the Taliban and put in Karzai, but, you know, what was the view? I mean, it seems like, you know, this was a mixed blessing. You got rid of the Taliban, but you also, the United States was now in, you know, literally Iran's backyard.
Yeah, I think they found it quite problematic. I mean, it was, you know, the devil you know is something. They understood the Taliban. I don't think they really respected the Taliban or even really feared the Taliban. But they didn't like the Taliban. But having the U.S. military in all of its sort of glory and technological prowess being right on your border, I mean, that's serious. And I think they rightly understood that part of what was going on in Afghanistan was also sort of related to Iran. I think they thought it was problematic, to say the least. But the problem with the IRGC is that they never were able to develop a network, a cadre, military group or allied military group within Afghanistan to the same extent they were able to in Iraq or in Lebanon. They had various Hazara groups and they had various sort of Tajik groups in the north that they would give money to, and you know, maybe they could get something out of it, but they never really had those strong relationships with them, and they weren't able to do it in the 80s or the 90s, and so I think they knew that they had a deficiency in Afghanistan in terms of how they could exert influence.
So let's go one more year into Iraq. So now I think, you know, in 2003, you know, the United States overthrew Saddam and sort of would begin rebuilding Iraq and what would become a democracy. So what was, you know, initially, what was the reaction in 2003 up until 2005? Because it seems like until you get the parliament, until you get the Iraqi government free of the CPA in 2005 with the election of, Jafari, of the Dawa Party, it seems like Iran was sort of cooling on the scene, sort of building relationships, you know, poking and pressuring its Iraqi proxies like Skiri, the Supreme Council of Islamic Revolution in Iran. But, you know, walk us through up until Ahmadinejad's election. Well, you know, what was the reaction of the IRGC? I mean, was this, to them, was this just a wonderful opportunity, or was this more sort of sitting back and sort of thinking about the problem and then slowly pushing in to Iraq?
I think it was a mixed blessing for them. You know, they certainly saw the opportunity. And the Supreme Council, you know, of course, the Badr organization, which was the armed element of the Supreme Council, had long been essentially a part of the Revolutionary Guards. I mean, they were sort of the Iraqi contingent of the Revolutionary Guards. So the Revolutionary Guards and Iran, you know, more broadly, firmly understood that what they lacked in Afghanistan, they did not lack in Iraq. They knew the terrain, they knew the people, they had long held networks in Iraq that now were in diaspora that would return. So I think they felt far more confident. And whereas the Taliban was a nuisance, Saddam Hussein was the main strategic enemy. And seeing him toppled, you know, by your other enemy, I think was indeed a blessing. I think what they feared, and rightly so, was like Afghanistan, now they have the U.S. Army on both sides of them. And this was a problem. But I think it was a problem that they were much more comfortable in knowing how to sort of initiate or manage, rather, than the Afghanistan issue.
So that year in 2003, so you, I think it was 2003, that Bush, no, 2004, excuse me, where Bush called Iran the sort of the axis of evil, or included Iran in the axis of evil. What was the reaction? I mean, it seems like, especially with Afghanistan, the Khatami government, I mean, according to public sources, had extended a sort of hand to the government saying, you know, not we're on your side, but sort of we have common interests. So what was the reaction, you know, of the IRGC to sort of, you know, being included in the axis of evil and sort of going from 2004 on?
Well, I mean, it was, in some sense, it was a turning point. Khatami was already a lame duck, you know, president. It was his last term. He was embattled. He couldn't get any of his initiatives across. His own activists at, you know, at home were easily sort of roughed up and, in some sense, brutalized by the security forces like the Basij and the IRGC. So this, I think, for them was a very clear testament to what they always thought about the United States, and that was that the United States thought of them as evil, thought of them as wicked, thought of them as a major enemy, and this was just Bush sort of putting a fine point on it. So I don't think it really changed much for them. I think what it did do, though, is it made them feel that they were more firmly in the crosshairs of this administration than they had been in previous administrations. And this made them more forward-leaning in their decision-making regarding Iraq than they would have been otherwise, I think. You know, they saw Iraq as a prelude to something else, possibly. And so I think what they decided to do in Iraq, ultimately, was to harass the United States so that the United States would see that there would be some real drawback to engaging in Iran military or threatening Iran militarily, because Iran was able to target essentially American forces there at will.
But I mean, I guess we'll get into this, but so in 2005 you have the election of Ahmadinejad, right? And so, you know, in parallel you also have the sort of the election of, in Iraq, a very sort of democratic government, but it's democratic in such a way that there's strong leanings and ties to Iran. So this is Jafari, I forget his first name, and I apologize.
Ibrahim
Jafari and sort of the Dawood Party, but the circumstances of the war were in such a way that, you know, a lot of Shiite parties and a lot of extreme Shiite parties were sort of, you know, making an outreach to Iran for money, guns, support. And at the same time, Iran was sort of stepping up its support of these groups. But, you know, walk us through, you know, Ahmadinejad's initial relationship with the IRGC. Because it seems like, you know, at least politically, people were saying that, you know, Ahmadinejad was elected, or the preference was for Ahmadinejad because he was indeed a war veteran. You know, he had ties to the IRGC. And the fact that the IRGC was sort of coming into a larger strategic and political role because of Iraq. But, you know, walk us through at least the initial relationship.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to say who the IRGC preferred, or even if you can speak of the IRGC sort of in that sort of monolithic terms in when it comes to voting. But I do think that the organization writ large did prefer Ahmadinejad over the other candidates. You know, Mohammed Bakhir Ghalibaf was also a candidate at the time. He was also a former IRGC Air Force commander, originally a Basiji, a war veteran, also the police commander in Tehran during 1999. Mohsen Rezaei, the former IRGC commander-in-chief, was also running. So there was lots of IRGC guys running at the time. Ahmadinejad was a fairly low figure in the IRGC or Besiege. I'm not even sure which, or if it's even confirmed precisely where he served. You get multiple accounts of where he was. Kurdistan, some say. But he was definitely a very strong advocate of war veterans. In fact, I mean, you know, one of the things he was doing was turning Iranian parks into the graveyards of unknown soldiers, right? Which was sort of ruining picnics for everybody.
Right.
Because they became haram for that kind of stuff afterwards. But he was really, really making himself well-loved by the IRGC. He was seen as the Besiege candidate. He would go around the countryside, he would meet with Besiegees, he'd meet with war veterans. And the IRGC made every signal that this type of humble, devout, pro-war veteran kind of guy was who the preferred candidate would be. And he's really, I mean, one of the only ones that made that persona fit. I mean, Balibaf at this time, you know, he was criticized for showing up on the day where you register, I think in a white suit, you know, and like Ray-Ban glasses, and, you know, his shirt unbuttoned, and kind of Miami Vice or you know, South Beach kind of style. And it was something that they all criticized him for. You know, who are you trying to get with this vote? You know, that it scared them, whereas Ahmadinejad was playing no bones. He was a war veteran, Besiegee. Yeah, they supported him pretty strongly. And if you believe the rumor intelligence that came out during the election, you know, they helped engineer it on his behalf. Besiegee stuffed ballot boxes. They did all sorts of things to help him get elected. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But that election, I think, like 2009, was not fully democratic. I don't think the votes were... The final tally was probably accurately told, at least in the first round, when Ahmadinejad sort of came out of nowhere to be the top candidate. But they certainly seemed to support him and probably helped him win the election.
So, where do you see sort of, you know, after outlining this history for us, where do you see the relationship of the IRGC now to, you know, what is the relationship with the Supreme Leader? I mean, do you see this as a sort of tense relationship? Because it seems like, you know, Ahmadinejad definitely had a falling out with the Supreme Leader. And so, you know, where do we place this in this sort of triangle of the Supreme Leader, Ahmadinejad, and the IRGC leadership? I mean, to describe it as a triangle, is it accurate, or is this, you know, how does this political relationship work?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't describe it as a triangle. Ahmadinejad was, you know, was the favored candidate, but he wasn't in any way just sort of the IRGC guy. He was for a few years. I mean, he had very sort of important photo ops with the IRGC leadership and with Besiegee leadership. But ultimately, after the 2009 election, he burned it. Any bridges that he had with the IRGC leadership. I mean, he's now condemned in the same, you know, in the same language that they condemn Rafsanjani or Mousavi. I mean, he's totally on the outs. And Mashayi was a big reason for this. I mean, they hated Mashayi right off the bat. You know, they never liked this guy because he just said things that they didn't believe in. So he was sort of out of the picture. But the IRGC has never needed to view the president as an authority, because the president really doesn't have authority over the issues that the IRGC cares about, for the most part, right? Their primary issues are foreign affairs, strategic policy, military investment, and the nuclear program. All the domestic stuff, which is what the president really has more influence over, are tangential to the IRGC. I mean, sure, the Besiegees care about, you know, bad head job or whatever, but they're tangential to the major leadership. So it's really the Supreme Leader and the IRGC that need to be in line. And while there may be, you know, while there may be some divide between what the Supreme Leader wants and what IRGC leadership wants, the IRGC has never really stepped past that line of going against the Supreme Leader. They have always been submissive to the Supreme Leader. Any time that the Supreme Leader has changed important leadership. There's never been protest or conspiracy-laden theories of why that happened coming from the IRGC. They've been on board, and I think that's because it's sort of a you scratch my back, I scratch yours, that the Supreme Leader literally owes his position to the IRGC, because they supported him, and the Basiji supported him from his sort of investor, after Khomeini's death, through now. They were able to help him sort of outmaneuver Rafsanjani, outmaneuver Khatami, and even outmaneuver Ahmadinejad. And I think he knows that, and I think they know that they need him in place, doing what he does to give them legitimacy and to give them a place in the regime.
So, before we move on to current events, where do we place the relationship of the IRGC to the clergy? So to, to Qom, to Isfahan, to Mashhad, and to sort of the seminary schools there. I mean, is religion a concern for the IRGC beyond ideology and beyond rhetoric, or is this, or do they just, only look to the Supreme Leader and, whoever the Supreme Leader's representative is to the IRGC? I mean, how does this, what is their relationship to, the clergy?
Right.
Right.
Well, there's several answers to that question. I mean, one, you'd kind of want to unpack the term of the clergy, right? So there's lots of clergy, and lots of them disagree with each other. And the IRGC likes some of them, and they dislike a lot of others, right? Rafsanjani's a top cleric. They hate him. They don't like Rouhani. They don't like Karubi. There's lots of mullahs that they don't care for at all. Whereas they do have guys that they do like. Ahmad Khatami, Mesbayasi, all these kind of guys. And they have their own clergy. You have the Supreme Leader's representative to the IRGC, Saidi. You have his deputy, who are sort of in charge of political and ideological sort of policy within the IRGC. And then you have the Basij, which is very devoted to religious causes, and it is in some ways sort of a social religious organization with a paramilitary bent. At personal levels, at lower levels, and even in institutional levels, the clergy, religion, all play somewhat of a role, and are all important to some degree. I don't believe that the IRGC makes any decisions based on religion. That's my own sort of thing. Right. I think religion, ideology is malleable enough that you can sort of make it fit whatever policy you're going to strive for. And I think the IRGC has shown that pretty clearly over time. But they do find it important. They do treat it differently than the regular military does. For instance, the conscript that goes into an IRGC barracks is expected to pray regularly, to be more religiously involved, whereas that's less strict in the regular forces. It's not necessarily rigidly enforced, but it's something that's sort of prioritized. But in terms of, power politics, the IRGC stand alone. They need some support from the clergy to be legitimate. They see themselves as the army of the Vilayet de Paris, as the sort of guardians of that system. So they need that religious system to be there, or else they're no longer the guardians. So they need it there, and I think they believe in it to some degree. But it certainly doesn't dictate, I think, policy to them to any degree.
So let's move on to sort of two current issues. Their participation in Syria and the elections that are going to happen here in 2 weeks or so. So, what is the view? I mean, it seems like the IRGC is really participating in Syria in ways that, their role has sort of switched from being a supporter of insurgents to being a counterinsurgent. What do you see? I mean, is this something that is sort of weighing on the institutions of the IRGC? Is this something where their people are coming back to Iran in body bags? you know, what are the associated costs? Because I think this is definitely, you know, I feel like it's under-discussed, and we feel it's under-discussed because literally there's only one other scholar here in D.C. that has written a report on this. So, I mean, what is your feeling about the role in Syria?
It is under-discussed, and it's not just here. I mean, it's not discussed very much in Iran. I mean, Iran blogs might talk about it, but the Iranian press doesn't talk much about it. The IRGC talks very little about it. They either have sort of oblique references to what they're doing in Syria or flat-out denials that they're doing anything in Syria. And these sort of come out, you know, in twos. So according to the IRGC, they're doing very little, if anything, in Syria. On the other hand, they're clearly involved, and they've said that they're involved. And their strategy, if we have any insight to it, I think is, for the most part, clear. I mean, one, they have a strategic ally in Assad. He's their, outside of Iraq, he's their only strategic ally in the entire region. You know, you can find other countries that do business with Iran, but you can't find any other countries that see Iran as a BFF, you know? They all see Iran as like, okay, thanks, we'll do this, but we're getting a lot more from China, Russia, the United States, or the EU than you can ever give us. Whereas Assad was different. The other thing that Assad was a pipeline to Hezbollah,
right,
which Iran needs and counts on, because the one thing that makes Iran relevant above all else on the global scene is their involvement in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict through Hezbollah. That gets them a seat at the big boys' table, or at least they feel like it should give them a seat at the big boys' table, and they're not going to relinquish that, if ever, unless they get some grand bargain, and they feel like that's their chip. That's their chip, is being involved in what they see as the United States' most precious issue in the Middle East. So they don't want to lose that. You know, some people have debated. In fact, I was discussing with some Iranians about this, who said, even some Lebanese who said, you know, Hezbollah is not going to lose anything if Iran goes. Hezbollah is going to be just fine. Iran's going to be just fine. They can just fly their weapons into Lebanon. And, you know, I don't know what the emails are like between Hezbollah and Iran. I don't have any access to that sort of fine-grained information. But the one thing I will say, and that I think is pretty clear, is both Iran and Hezbollah sure as hell seem to think that Syria is a big friggin' deal, and that losing Syria would be a big friggin' deal. And I don't think they would be fighting tooth and nail if they didn't think that. I don't think this is just some ego play that they're like, hey, it's our friend, we're gonna protect him, let's throw him a bone and do some stuff. So they certainly think it's important, and they're doing everything they can short of, you know, outright military, sort of a large-scale military involvement to help them. But, you know, what I see is the big gulf is that, no pun intended for the region, is that, yeah. I get caught on that one every time. Is that there's really no domestic pressure to not be doing stuff in Syria for Iran right now, because there's not those body bags coming home. This isn't their Vietnam at the moment. There isn't mass casualties. There's been some high-level casualties. There's probably a lot of low-level casualties that we don't know of. You know, a lot of that reporting is coming from Syrian rebels, right?
Well, where would you put sanctions then? I mean, it seems like Iran's participation in Syria, you know, it's low-key, right? You have Hezbollah doing most of the heavy lifting in terms of fighting, and their commanders are sort of, according to press reports, are sort of standing back and sort of giving the orders, but it seems like, you know, Iran is giving a lot of money to Syria, and it just seems like post-2010, when you had the Obama administration pass these really deep-cutting and in-depth sanctions, that, you know, financially, this doesn't seem like it's not very sustainable. So I think,
I don't think it's sustainable at all, but Iran has been incredibly nimble at managing its own failures, economically, politically, strategically. So I think that they are far more confident than I am of them in thinking that they can get through this on whatever resources they have. I mean, they just, you know, today I just read a report that Iran was opening up a $4 billion credit line to Assad, you know, and that to me was kind of funny because I was thinking that was just an expansion of Iran's own credit line to other countries, you know. So I don't know if they're going to turn Indian rupees into credit for, you know, for helping Assad, or how they're going to do it, or if they have the reserves to do it, or if this is just all bluster and they're just hoping to make Assad sort of indebted to them, or if nothing comes of it whatsoever. But, I mean, they're certainly limited in what they're pouring into this adventure. It's really hard to know, and I don't think anybody can say with any clarity what exactly Iran is spending on Syria, what resources exactly it has in there. We know that there's probably several hundred to several thousand Quds Force guys there. There's probably Basijis there. There's probably other sort of IRGC elements there. They seem to be working with Hezbollah very closely and working with these other Syrian militias in setting up sort of this counter-resistance or whatever. But how much Iran is spending, how much toll Iran is sort of taking from this is unclear. If this goes on a decade, then I think it's a different story. But if this goes on another 2-3 years, I think Iran can manage it, because it's, from what I'm seeing, this is maybe, you know, 10 times what they were doing in Iraq, but what they were doing in Iraq didn't seem to cost them anything. I think they see it as a worthy investment. You know, if they can retain Damascus, if they can retain the coast, if they can retain that pipeline through Hussein, you know, to Hezbollah, and Hezbollah sort of remains what it is, and Assad and whatever his group of folks, whatever they become, as long as they have some manner of territory that Iran can sort of use, I think it'll be a success.
It seems like the argument, I mean, I think the comparison to Iraq falls short, because in Iraq, it was the United States that created order. It was the United States that was largely responsible for creating order and creating governance. So then if we, you know, step back to our analogy and say, well, in Lebanon, in the 80s and 90s, you know, Iran could develop Hezbollah in any fashion it wanted, because Syria was in charge of managing, you know, the political element and political order in Lebanon. I mean, I think in Syria now, there's no sort of, you know, even if you sort of argue that Assad is in charge of creating that central order, he's not doing it very well. And in fact, I would argue that he's failing. I mean, he's failing big time. But, I mean, it just seems like this sort of endeavor for Iran is not going to be 4 years, 5 years, but 6-7, as you said, maybe even a decade. I mean, this might be sort of, you know, what was Israel's south, or the United States' Iraq. But, I mean, that's more conjecture than, you
yeah.
know, that's more thesis and conjecture than sort of, you know, evidenced argument.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say. You don't know where it's going and, you know, what's going to happen, you know, 4 months from now, much less 4 years from now. But Iran isn't, you know, aside from whatever military resources they're putting into Syria, they're not investing a whole lot. I mean, if they spend $4 billion, that is a whole lot, you know. So they could end up making a major investment, but they're not in charge of stabilizing anything. I mean, I think they're just in the killing business there. You know, they're helping managing the slaughter, essentially. They, you know, but for them, it's a strategic end. You know, they're helping an ally. They're helping sort of keep their strategic ally in place. But I think for them, it does not matter whether Syria remains Syria. It just matters that their friends control some territory. And that territory can be small. You know, they don't need Aleppo. They don't need Hama. You know, they don't need a lot of these cities. They just need Damascus. They need the military factories outside of Damascus. They need the highway to Lebanon. And they need the coast, at least parts of the coastlines. And, you know, and similarly, you know, the border areas with Lebanon. I mean, I think that's all they're interested in. So I think from the Iranian perspective, even if Syria were to evaporate, so long as it becomes Balkanized, and they have a partner in that new order, they'll be okay.
So let's end, you know, for our last sort of bit of the conversation, let's talk about the elections. So I think we have a, there's an approved list of candidates now that you have. I'll just read them off. Mohammad Reza Arif, Ghalibaf, which we've already mentioned, Haddad, Ghulam Ali Haddad Adel, Saeed Jalili, Mohsen Rezaei, Hassan Rouhani, and Ali Akbar Belayati. So, you know...
There's a Qarazi in there, too.
Maybe I missed it.
It's okay. He doesn't matter.
Oh, okay.
No offense to him, but he's not going to get anybody's vote.
Anyway, but, I mean, who do you... How do you sort of... Is there an IRGC candidate? I mean, it seems like, you know, Ahmadinejad was able to come to power based on the sort of the war veterans movement sort of being, you know, not endorsed, but sort of supported by. I mean, do you see the same thing happening in this sort of list of candidates? I mean, or is this, you know, they don't really care anymore. They're just busy dealing with Syria, busy dealing yeah. with sanctions.
No, I think they do care. I think they care a lot. The one thing about this list is that it makes it a lot easier for them. I mean, there's several people that they would feel okay with. You know, Hassan Rouhani is not one of them. Neither is Mohammad Reza Arif. But neither of them are likely to get elected. I mean, maybe Rouhani can be the next Mousavi and get people excited. That's possible. But so far, it seems unlikely. So among the sort of cast of characters that are the most likely for the principalists or the hardliners to get elected are Ghalibaf, Haddad Adel, Jalili, and Velayati. Mohsen Rezaei runs every year. He gets, you know, his collection of votes from Dezful and from the south. But outside of the south, he's sort of irrelevant in the electorate, you know. And it's always been that case. So I think he uses it as a platform to suggest things to leadership, but not really as a serious candidate.
So let's walk through, because this is an interesting, the last four people that you have that on our list, Velayati and Jalili seem to be deeply involved in foreign policy. So Velayati is, correct me if I'm wrong, the former foreign minister, and then Jalili is the former nuclear negotiator. But then these last two, Ghalibaf and I think Haddad Adel, were... Ghalibaf was the mayor of Tehran.
He still is.
But it seems like there's a division here then, because there's domestic guys, domestic-oriented guys, and then foreign policy guys.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in terms of... I mean, which one do you think... I don't want you to tell us which one will win or who do you think will win, but rather, you know...
Well, in that case, I won't.
Oh, okay. Womp, womp. I mean, do you think there's a... I mean, do you
no,
think a more domestic-oriented candidate will win? Because...
I think... you know, one, it's a little soon. I think if you give 2 weeks... if you get into the second week of June or, you know, the end of the first week of June, I think you're going to see more and more press, you know, coming out in support of one guy or slightly questioning another guy's sort of qualities. You know, they're not going to target any of the principalists, you know, very hard. You know, they're going to say nice things about all of them because all of them are close to the supreme leader in one way or another. All of them are close to them in one way or another, so they're not going to alienate certain guys. But I think the front runners are Jalili and Ghalibaf. And I say this for two reasons. One, because I think they are, just abstractly. I think they have the best chance of winning. Jalili has gotten the most sort of push from the hardline press, and Ghalibaf is the most well-rounded, if I can say, the sensible candidate for the hardliners, that the hardliners could even possibly hope to put forward. He's an actual executive. He has actual experience. Unlike Ahmadinejad, who had only been mayor for a couple of years, he's been mayor for, I don't know, almost 8 years, 6 years, something like that. He's done a reasonable job as manager of Tehran. He's won some international Mayor of the Year awards.
The implication of Alibaba winning is that as a police chief, he had no problem, you know, pardon my the turn of phrase, you know, whooping ass and basically, you know, enforcing order when it needed to be enforced, regardless of civil rights or whatever. And it seems like with Jalili, you know, with his experience on the nuclear ticket, it seems like it would almost be a signal to the United States that, you know, here's, we elected the president of, you know, a serious guy, serious foreign policy-oriented person who could possibly be negotiated with, you know, just over the nuclear issue. So, I mean...
Yeah. I think their thinking is completely opposite of that. It is much more who is going to protect our equities and our position here at home the best. Who's going to change things the least? Who's going to be the least resistant to the guidance of the Supreme Leader and to the guidance or suggestion or influence of the IRGC? Jalili seems to be the most sort of malleable in this way. He's humble. He's a war veteran. They all like him. And he has shown no real ambition to change things, right? Like his big sort of domestic policy initiative was we should, you know, invest less in popsicle sticks and use that money for the poor, right? This was his, you know, his big sort of venture into domestic economic politics. And he's probably a more serious guy than that. But he doesn't need to be more serious than that. Whereas Golubov is much more of an interesting figure. I mean, the reason why he wasn't supported in 2005 and ultimately didn't run in 2009 is because he didn't gain the trust that he needed to from the Supreme Leader's office and from the IRGC, at least, and maybe from certain clergy. That's how I see it. That, you know, like his Don Johnson sort of moment in 2005, I think really hurt him. And it made him feel like, okay, this is a modern candidate, which is a bad word. You know, this is a Western-leaning candidate, which is a bad omen. How do we know that he really is just like us? You know, that he's not a sheep in wolf's clothing, right? They want the wolf. Whereas Jalili is less mysterious. But there was an interesting... There was a poll done by Fars News a couple days ago that came out that showed that Jalili and Golubov were number one and number two, or vice versa. But they were the top two candidates polled by Fars News. So you're thinking Fars News is going to have a more conservative leadership. That's probably pretty reflective of their electorate. So I think what they feel most about is that, one, the candidate needs to be flexible and willing to work, and certainly not an Ahmadinejad, you know, not have that personal ambition, not have that sort of independent or rogue streak, you know, not have a Sarah Palin going rogue kind of moment, which they all see Ahmadinejad as, and just be a guy that's going to toe the line and not make any hiccups for them, sort of in foreign policy or domestic policy throughout. And I think Jalili is the most likely candidate in that sense. However, Golubov, like I said, I think is probably the best candidate. You know, in fact, I remember in 2009, I gave a talk which was basically all about Golubov, and he could be, you know, the primary candidate. I had no idea about Ahmadinejad at the time. But I think for that reason, I think he won't win for that reason. But I think it's going to be one of those two. I wouldn't be surprised either way. If it's Golubov, I would think that would be interesting, because it would sense to me that they want a more serious president, you know, somebody that could be taken a little more seriously in the international scene, sort of a stronger-looking president. If it's Jalili, I think it's sort of this conceit that the presidency matters less and less, you know, as time goes along, that they don't want it to matter any more than it did under Ahmadinejad, and that he's just there to sort of steer sort of domestic budgets, you know, in whatever way the Supreme Leader wants.
Now, for my final question, I mean, do you think there's going to be another sort of 2009 moment where you have protests or you have dissension, but it seems like, you know, the real outlier with a serious constituency would be somebody like Ahmadinejad or sort of war veterans who are sort of, who, you know, would agree with Ahmadinejad and sort of approve of Ahmadinejad. I mean, do you see something like that happening, or is this, you know, is really security has been tightened to the point, and, you know, the security situation has been anticipated to the point where it's going to be not a quiet election, but certainly nothing like 2009, 2010.
I would be surprised if it goes like 2009, just because they have been preparing for it a long time. The IRGC, the Bastige, if you read their press, has been terrified of this moment. They feel like this is, you know, the sanctions play into this and as sort of this grand scheme that, that the U.S. is going to use, and Israel are going to use the election as sort of their moment to do whatever they fear them doing. So I think the security will be there. I think the passion's a little bit deflated, but you never know. I mean, that pro-democratic passion or impulse within within Iran, I think is real, and who knows what's going to inspire to bring it out. I don't see it, but I didn't see it, you know, a month before the 2009 elections either. So I think to make a guesstimate either way is premature. But I will say that the IRGC is anticipating it and doing everything they can to prevent it. I think, you know, what will be most interesting is seeing how the regime insiders, how they react to the election, right? You already have you know, some weird messaging happening in the press, like you know, the mythic Qasem Soleimani, the Quds Force commander, supposedly has endorsed Qalibaf. This came out in a report a couple days ago, and then there was a report today or yesterday in Force News that that said that some IRGC public relations commander said that no, this is not the case. The IRGC doesn't endorse anybody as a matter of course, which is true. They never officially endorse anybody. So that doesn't mean it's untrue. You know, if Qasem Soleimani has as much power and mojo inside the regime as some people think, his endorsement of Qalibaf may be enough. You know, whether he minds Jalili at all, you know, whether he doesn't also endorse Jalili is up for grabs. And whether this is all BS and never happened, who knows, you know. Mesbah Yazdi, I think, has endorsed Jalili, but he's also meeting with Qalibaf. So, you know, you have some of these hardline figures that are important to the hardliners that are sort of making it interesting among these two. You know, you'll see, and you'll see what Ahmadinejad, if he has anything to say about it, whether Mashayi comes back, whether they have some third way revolt. I don't think they would, you know, there's all sorts of things that could happen. But I anticipate a quiet election. I would not be surprised if it's more interesting than that.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. That was... great interview. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
No problem.